present the news quiz with your chairman, Barry Took.
Hello and welcome again to the news quiz. We start with a correction in the Sunday Express, read by Charlotte Green.
On page 35 of this week's section 3, we feature a recipe for lemon tart. Readers should note that while the method is correct, the ingredient should include lemons.
Well, thank you, Anne Welsh of Gloucester, for sending us that. Well, now let's meet the teams. Would you welcome first, on my right, Ian Hislop and Steve Punt. And facing them, on my left, Alan Corran and Martin Young. Before we start round one, here's a plea from the Metro News, sent in by Peter Castry of Manchester.
Can you give a home to a stray? Please state if a cat or dog is required and enclose a stamped addressed envelope.
Ian, your question, where was Restoring Democracy Peanuts?
Yes, I think I noticed this one. This was the non-invasion of Haiti. The Americans decided they were really going to go in there and get rid of the dictator. And then, at the last minute, they negotiated so he would stay in for a month and then not leave Haiti but go and retire to the country. And then they would go in anyway and be photographed. This was a deal worked out by Jimmy Carter, hence the peanuts reference. I think rather than the cost of the operation, which is 7 zillion billion pounds, for American troops to stand by and watch Haiti and policemen kill people.
You're absolutely right, Ian. This was Operation Restore Democracy. The invasion of Haiti went off peacefully after the intervention by Jimmy Carter, the old peanut king. John Major was so impressed he's invited Percy Dalton to sort out Ulster for him. In fact, the operation went so easily, the 82nd Airborne arrived in holiday chartered jets. And it's just as well it was peaceful, their tanks got sent to Gatwick. Steve, nice to have you on the programme. Your question is this. What's become a big employment issue to the Department of Employment?
Yes, well, this is presumably the big issue. Is it the magazine? And Peter Lilly's after them. I don't know why. Perhaps because he feels that they have been rather successful. So, being a good Tory, perhaps he feels there's a successful small business. It should perhaps be taken over, bought up, taken up market, made glossy and colourful and renamed homeless and gardenless. The interesting thing is that the people who sell the big issue, if they weren't doing that, they'd be asking you for the price of a cup of tea. And it said in the papers that they can earn up to £10 a day selling the big issue, which in the West End of London is the price of a cup of tea. So I think they deserve a bit of sympathy, really.
Absolutely right.
I'd like to put in a word for Peter Lilly as the Mother Teresa of British politics. I think he's a terrific guy. I just want to hear a word against him.
No wonder you were sacked by the Beeb.
This is the news that the Department of Employment is attempting to investigate big issue sellers, but the publisher of the magazine, John Bird, won't hand over their names and addresses. The answer is they're all called Jimmy, and they haven't got addresses. That's sort of the point, really. Martin, nice to have you back on the programme.
Thank you very much, Brad. I'm amazed that John Bird has got time to do the big issue as well as run the BBC. He's a man of many talents, isn't he?
Well, he makes them unemployed, and then he gets them to sell the paper.
I think I ought to make it clear I actually meant John Bird. Martin, your question now. Who didn't curry favour with the Cape Crusader?
Mr. Major. I think he's the Prime Minister, isn't he? I'm pretty hot on these things. I know about the government.
Unlike him.
No, but you've got to remember always, I'm still here. It was Mrs. Thatcher, the Baroness, who said, don't put any money in South Africa, the place is going to be like Rwanda any moment. And this didn't go down terribly well with Howard Davis from the CBI and all sorts of other really rather classy people touring South Africa saying, this is the place! Didn't go down at all well. And Major is incandescent.
I love the idea that Mrs. Thatcher's suddenly against investment in South Africa. Makes a change, doesn't it?
It's all about John Major's trip to South Africa, where he was trying to promote investment. This was marred by Mrs. Thatcher, intimating that British firms might not invest in South Africa because of potential unrest. Lady Thatcher was speaking from her tour of India, where cows are sacred. So John Major shouldn't really have replied. Allen. Will you have a listen to this?
Roll another one. Just like the other one. You've been hanging on to it. Then I sure would like a hit. Don't bogart that joint, my friend. Pass it over to me. Don't bogart that joint, my friend. Pass it over to me.
Well, that was the fraternity of man singing Don't Bogart Me, whatever that might mean.
And it your means to all the joints in all the world. Yeah, don't smoke mine.
Oh, right. Oh. Your question is a bit easier than that bit of music. Like, it's what policies went to pot?
This is Hashdown, isn't it? The wonderful unified force that is the Lib, Lab, Dem, Conservative, Green Pot Pact. It's been meeting in Brighton to decide on the 1,400 policies represented by its 1,400 delegates. And they decided to smoke things and get happy. Because you have to do that if you're a Liberal Democrat. And it upset that moral paragon, Paddy Ashdown, deeply, who really doesn't think people should sit around smoking. He thinks they should.
Alan?
Lie around smoking afterwards.
This was the Liberal Democrat conference where the membership seemed intent on bending over backwards to embarrass Paddy Ashdown. So no change there. After they won the vote to legalise marijuana, supporters celebrated by getting as mellow as newts and went on the rampage tidying up their hotel rooms. Security staff were worried cigarettes at the conference might contain pot, so they tested some and then they weren't worried at all. The scores at the end of the first round of the news quiz are, as they always are, for all. Well done, chap. Ian, your turn for a question again. Whose lack of silence means Guinness could be good for him?
Oh, this is it's another triumph for justice. This time European justice. Mr. Ernest Saunders, who was sent down for false accounting fraud, all the usual sort of things you do in the city, about 4 years ago, when he was working for Guinness, has appealed to the European Court of Human Rights, who've decided that because he was investigated by the Department of Trade and Industry, who asked him all these questions, you know, like, are you guilty, he could have incriminated himself. Absolutely appalling thought. Man just going about doing an illegal share operation and the guy gets investigated. Absolutely amazing. So they've said that Guinness and Saunders were very badly treated and that Ernest Saunders should not have been convicted on that evidence. And Saunders, who you may remember went to prison for, I think, 5 minutes out of a very long sentence because he got Alzheimer's disease. And then luckily he forgot he had it. Came out of prison, made a miraculous recovery, and is now back in business. And he's now saying he's going to claim compensation from the government. Can you believe it? We, the taxpayer, have got to pay up because Saunders is a crook. Unbelievable.
Pure genius, though.
Pure genius.
This is the former Guinness chief, Ernest Saunders, who may win compensation after a European court claimed the denial of his right to remain silent undermined his case. Well, that and a large bag he had labelled swag. The court heard how Saunders faced 2 years in jail if he refused to talk, a penalty brought in as a result of that infamous case, the Crown versus Sooty. Steve. Whose science fictions became science facts?
This is Jules Verne.
Oui.
I believe. French science fiction writer. See, I knew that. And, yes, he wrote... What did he write? He wrote Around the World in 80 Days, did he not?
He did.
University Challenge or something.
Yes. And, no, but they found an unpublished manuscript of his, which is called Paris or something, and in which he predicted all sorts of things about the 20th century, which have all come mysteriously true, or most of them have. He predicted underground railways and even predicted which escalators would be working at any particular time. I think he predicted the fax machine.
Yes.
And also predicted that the last two lines would always be illegible.
Absolutely right, in every particular, well done. This is about long-lost novel by Jules Verne from 1863 called Paris in the 20th Century. He predicted such innovations as the Underground Railway and the electric chair. What a cruel punishment that is, being made to sit on the Northern Line. However, Martin, here's a piece of music for you.
I've never seen a straight banana. I've searched every town. I've seen bananas standing up and seen them lying down. I've tried everywhere to find one, Africa, Jamaica and Havana. But I've never
I've never seen a straight banana, sung by Jimmy Edwards there. And your question is, whose unbending legislation bore fruit?
Yes. It's the reason why Michael Portillo is sitting over there right now, even as we speak, like a Trappist monk saying nothing, because he doesn't believe in Europe. And the reason he doesn't believe in Europe is because they want to have a certain amount of bendiness in bananas. And this is why we signed the Maastricht Treaty.
Right.
And I'm jolly proud that my banana, my Euro banana, is going to be the right sort of bendiness.
Right.
I think we can be proud as Britons.
I think
not, it's not just bendy, it's got to be 5.5 inches long,
right,
an inch wide.
I don't want to talk to you about this.
And have no bruises on it. It doesn't seem too much to ask.
I just knew you would pull rank on me there. 5.5 inches long.
Could have pulled almost anything. Question.
One has to be extremely cautious with banana questions, I've found over the years. But this is the latest in a long line of legislation on Euro fruits. According to the EU Commission, the standard banana can be no less than 5.5 inches long and must not be excessively curved. They didn't define how you measure an excessive curve in your banana. But anyone who may be concerned theirs is too bent should, as a precaution, immediately throw it away. If it comes back, it's failed. Alan, who found old Uncle Ram was only human?
Is it about a sheep?
It could Ram. Well be. I've seen the pictures in the papers.
I mean, it's not the missing tooth.
Yes.
I don't know what Uncle Ram's got to do with it. He's called Australopithecathopus ramidus.
Not on this bit of paper,
well,
isn't
it? Well, I mean, it's only 4 million years old. I thought it was a bit familiar. Well, they found this tooth in Ethiopia, and they found a fragment of lettuce on it, and they have concluded that he's the missing link between the Liberals and the Labour Party. Ashdown Man and Paddington Blair are brought together in one fell swoop. No, they found this African tooth. It's 4 million years old, and it's got this food on it, and they've concluded that he was a vegetarian, or we were vegetarians. And they've actually drawn the conclusion that I'm related to Martin Young. Horrifying thought. It's the oldest living thing. I mean, it's 7 years older than Barbara Cartman. It's all our uncles.
This is all about man's oldest ancestor, Uncle Ram, a short, hairy, thick-set hominid, classified as Homo Bob Hoskinus.
Well, all right, use a phone, go on.
A Japanese archaeologist, Professor Gensua, discovered the 4 million-year-old man in Ethiopia. He appears to have died after a huge pile of telegrams from the Queen fell on him. And the scores at the end of round two are still tied at 8-all. We start round three with a piece from the Sellafield newsletter.
In addition to his work at Sellafield, which will take up to 12 hours a week, the Reverend Galloway will also ruin the parish of Gosford.
Well, thank you, D. Ashton of Stafford, for that. Ian, your question again. What is to be scrapped on cue by law?
Queuing for bananas.
Do you know this, honestly?
Well, of course I don't know this, Barry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But Steve does, before Corin sneaks in to try and get a bonus.
Yes, I do.
There's meant to be on my team, not just sitting there smugly thinking, ah,
I know that. No, I know this. There's one of these sort of bizarre English laws that we have that have been around for hundreds of years but no one knows about. And there is actually a law that says that if you're waiting for something in Britain, you have to queue. You can't just mill around for a bus. It is actually illegal to stand around in a group and wait for a bus or for a cup of tea or anything. But this law has never, ever been put into practice ever since the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And because of this, they're abolishing it.
Yes, this is London Transport Bylaw that requires bus queues to be orderly with no pushing in. And it was introduced in 1938 with a penalty fine of £2. And despite never being enforced, no one can remember seeing an unruly queue since. Come to think of it, quite a few people haven't seen a bus since then either. Also requires queues to be no more than two persons deep and was designed to control football crowds, except at Charlton, where the rule is no more than two persons long. Steve, will you have a listen to this?
Face at first, just go sleep. Turn the wider shade of pale.
Now that was Procol Harum, of course, with Whiter Shade of Pale. And your question is, what whiter shade is now a shade clearer?
I do know this, because good, believe it or not, a white shade of pale is not in the news every week. You sort of notice it when it is. They've found an extra verse which makes it clear what it was about, because the lyrics are completely incomprehensible. We skipped the light fandango, didum didum didum, you know, all the rest of it. And they've discovered a middle verse, which they never recorded, which makes it quite clear that it was all about a sort of 60s drug orgy, and the Liberal Democrats are adopting it as their theme song next year, aren't they?
Martin, who have sailed straight into the eye of a language storm?
Yes, it's obviously the language storm on a cross-channel ship where they're bobbing up and down. And obviously there's a big problem about whether or not they speak French or English on the cross-channel ferry. So I think that's the answer to the question. I like the point.
No, it's half the answer. I'll give you one. Oh, Alan, can you...
Steve knows the answer.
Did you see the pitiful way his little eyes swiveled towards my pad? To no avail. I have no idea what this is about.
Maybe that they don't know whether to speak English or French on cross-channel ferries, but all the cross-channel ferries I've ever been on, they haven't bothered with either. They just go...
I'll give you a bonus for that, yes, I'm quite right. This is the French who have demanded British cross-channel ferry staff should be able to speak their language. Our seamen have responded with the old English nautical phrase beginning with P and O. A spokesman for the British sailors said the demand was unnecessary as most of our crews were already rampantly bilingual. At least I think that's what he said. Meanwhile, staff on the Channel Tunnel are preparing for its grand opening by mastering the phrase, closed for repairs. Alan, where will a slower standard of service have a good net result?
A slower standard of service, I mean, I have to confess, this is not... It's not about the man in Kathmandu who swallowed 53,000 quid in coins.
No.
And the police are... That was a very good story. A Nepalese swallowed £53,000 in coins. And the police are sort of waiting. I don't know this thing. Do you know anything about
And they
this
said, can so I, far, no confirm? Change. Steve.
Ian.
Ian Steve. Now, well, now Steve, that you know each other, things. Answer the question.
It's about plans to have a compulsory underarm service. No, because tennis is so boring. Men's tennis is too fast, so you've got to slow it down.
It would be that sort of thing, yeah. You know that.
These are proposals to make Wimbledon more exciting by getting the balls to travel more slowly. There are two ways of doing this, either by changing the balls, or if they really want to slow it down, by insisting that only English players are allowed to enter. Actually, that's a bit unfair. Our last great Wimbledon player could hit the ball so hard, his top hat used to fall off. Scores at the end of the third round have changed dramatically because Alan Corran and Martin Young are 9, but Ian Hislop and Steve Punt are 13. Before we start the final round, here's an advertisement from The Times sent in by Isabel Berman of Coventry.
The law officers of the Crown, Guernsey, require an experienced criminal and common lawyer.
Plenty of those around. Thank you for that, Isabel. Ian, here's a piece of music for you.
I heard your mother now, she's going out the door. Did she go to work or just go to the store? All those things she said I told you to ignore.
That was a chap called Blondie singing Hanging on the Telephone. And your question is, what first-time caller ran up £1,000 worth of trouble?
It's Diana, isn't it?
No.
Blondie?
No, come along. First-time caller, £1,000 worth, in all the papers. Steve knows.
Yes, it's in all the Daily Telegraphs, I think.
Really?
Every single copy.
Every single one.
Well, come on then, Smuggy, spit it out.
No, he knows, he knows.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't. Oh, well, you know those phones you can get with, like, where you can press one button and it dials the whole number for you?
Oh, right.
You know, yeah. And you have the local pizza place and your granny and stuff. And a three-year-old picked up a phone and pressed one and dialed his aunt in St. Lucia.
That's right.
And then he left the phone off the hook all night.
The essence of the story is right. You've got some of the detail wrong, but I'll give you your points for that. This is one-year-old Joe Williams, who managed to call his great-grandparents in the West Indies and then leave the phone off the hook for 25 hours. The agonising 25-hour pause delighted Joe's great-grandparents, who thought they were getting a personal call from Harold Pinter. British Telecom wrote off the £1,000 cost of the call, which will be news to Joe as he's been sent to his room until he's 38. Steve, saviour of your side, where can you get hip to his lordship?
This is Radio 3, isn't it? Now, Radio 3 have had a bit of an image crisis for the last couple of years, and they conducted some extensive market research of both their listeners, and they found that they were unanimous that they should have more pop on their network. So Radio 3 have decided to do a programme investigating fearlessly into the nether reaches of contemporary acid jazz and hip-hop. But being Radio 3, they've decided to get the 7th Earl of Onslow to present it. So this is Radio 3, and we're going to kick it, yo.
That's absolutely excellent. This is the Radio 3 series, which will feature thrash metal, hip-hop, and lots of rap. Presumably the sea is silent. Super tunes. Thank you, Classic FM listeners. Super tunes will be presented by that funky hipster, the 7th Earl of Onslow, who at 56 is too old for rap and too young for the Rolling Stones. Martin, who tried to put an affair in train with her one track in mind?
Gorgeous. Have you been reading the same papers as us this week?
This is a woman who, during the signalman strike, became so incensed by signals not going up and down, she found herself fantasising about railway drivers. And there was this very tall railway driver, a bit ginger. I mean, not ginger in your sense. I mean, actually, a real ginger railway driver. And she started writing him letters saying that she, I don't want to do jokes about tender behind, but I will have to if forced. And she wanted to have her way with him, and British Rail sacked her. And she went to an industrial tribunal and said, this is enormously unfair. You can't sack me. And it's the first case of sexual harassment successfully brought by a man against a woman in England. And this tall ginger train driver is going to be compensated. He's going to go on holiday with Ernest Saunders.
I don't know why she couldn't have been on the buses. It's different. You don't have this for bus drivers.
This is Janet Hustwit, who was sacked from her job as a British Rail conductor after she told a driver she wanted to go all the way to crew, of course. 16 stone Janet wrote to Richard Gula, I'll make you smile. I'll make your eyes water. And at 16 stone, she's probably right. Janet admits she had a fetish for train drivers and model railway sets, but Richard wasn't going to let her get her hands on his Hornby. Alan, what carrier plans were put on ice?
I rather think this is Magnus Pike's cousin, Jeff. Magnus Pike, the late loony, had an even loonier cousin called Jeff. And during the war, Jeff, lonely, I suppose, for train drivers, bananas, anything else, was doodling with a pad in his room and came up with the idea for an aircraft carrier made out of ice. How long the planes would have stayed on the air, I mean, it's anybody's business, but ice. And these were going to be towed up on the Archangel Run and destroy Germany. They wouldn't have been very good on an Africa run where the planes would have ended up floating in the sea. Anyway, he put this to the US Navy. And the US Navy said, I don't think so, really. They were not impressed by Jeff Pike's ice boat. I thought it was rather good. Yes. There's a bloke who used to do a swan at the Savoy, who was rather special, but he couldn't land on it.
This is the book about the Second World War, which claims the British Navy planned to build giant aircraft carriers made of ice. To counter this threat, the Luftwaffe armed its Stuka squadrons with twists of lemon. During winter trials, a prototype ice carrier, HMS Brass Monkey, ran into difficulties when a sailor decided to grit the flight deck. Before we reveal the final scores, let's see what cuttings the teams have brought along. Ian, have you brought a cutting for us?
This is from the Daily Telegraph. It's all the papers I read. And it was a comment after the yobbery at that boxing match that got the chairman of the Tory party into such trouble. There was a disturbance there, and a spokesman was quoted in the Telegraph saying, "Any violence at a sporting event is unacceptable, especially at a boxing match."
Steve, have you got one for us?
This is from The Independent on Sunday. 24 people were seriously injured in Tokyo between 1988 and 1993 whilst bowing greetings to each other. Most of the injured citizens were nudged under trains, trapped in revolving doors, or plunged down escalators. Safe greeting zones have now been introduced.
Martin, got a cutting for us?
Yes, indeed. Courtesy of Reuters, in the Times, from Janet Green, is this. Gin for sin, Accra. To keep down unwanted births, a Ghana village chief has ruled that men impregnating girls under 18 will be fined £30, one sheep and three bottles of gin. The girls must pay £15.
Very good. Alan.
I have something, Barry, from the Warwick University Bulletin. Dr. Frank Hartford has asked us to apologise on his behalf for the cancellation of his guest lecture, From the Moon to Mars, Mankind's Next Giant Step. He was prevented from travelling to Warwick last Thursday by the signalman strike.
Thank you all, and so to the final score, which is quite interesting because Alan and Martin got 13, but Ian and Steve well in the lead, this week's winners with 17. Well done, chaps. Before we leave you, here's a cutting from the Daily Mirror, sent in by Valerie Sam of Leicester.
A Dalek was found guilty yesterday of attacking a barman at a Blackpool pub fancy dress party. Convicted with Simon Duncan were Jared Mike Tyson Walsh and Richard Dennis the Menace Bailey. Sentencing took place at Fleetwood Magistrates Court, where witnesses included the Pope and the back end of a cow.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Alan Corran, Ian Hislop, Steve Punt and Martin Young. The chairman was Barry Took and the news is read by me, Charlotte Green. The programme was written by Ian Pattinson and Robert Fraser-Steele. The producer was Aled Evans.